feeling is the remote
moment. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during a visit to Kyiv on Saturday. An aide to the Ukrainian leader said Johnson's visit to the Ukrainian capital followed trips to Kyiv of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the EU's foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell on Friday, and the visit of the Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer earlier on Saturday. Johnson's Downing Street office said he was in Ukraine for a show of solidarity with the country's people. The European visits come after Ukraine rebuffed Russian troops from the Kyiv region late last month. Meantime, Ukraine on Saturday called on civilians in the eastern Luhansk region to flee from amassing Russian forces after officials said more than 50 civilians trying to evacuate by rail from a neighboring region were killed in a missile attack the previous day. Air raid sirens sounded in cities across eastern Ukraine, which has become the focus of Russian military action in recent weeks following a withdrawal from areas close to Kyiv. Russia's invasion, which began on February 24th, has forced more than 4 million people to flee abroad, killed or injured thousands, left a quarter of the population homeless, and turned cities into rubble. The civilian casualties have triggered a wave of international condemnation, in particular over the deaths in the town of Bukha, a town to the northwest of Kyiv that until last week was occupied by Russian forces. Russia has denied targeting civilians in what it calls a special operation to demilitarize and denazify its southern neighbor. Ukraine and Western nations have dismissed this as a baseless pretext for war. This is VOA News. Russia continues to hit Ukrainian non-combatants, such as the civilians killed in Friday's rocket strike on that railway station in eastern Ukraine. That's what British military intelligence said on Saturday. Russian operations continue to focus on the Donbas region, Mariupol, and Mykolaiv, supported by continued cruise missile launches into Ukraine by Russian naval forces, the Ministry of Defense said, adding that Russia's ambitions to establish a land corridor between Crimea and the Donbas continue to be thwarted by Ukrainian resistance. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi said on Saturday Tehran would not give up its right to develop its nuclear industry for peaceful purposes, and all parties involved in talks to revive the 2015 nuclear accord should respect this. That's what state media is reporting. 11 months of indirect talks between Iran and the United States in Vienna have stalled, as both sides say political decisions are required by Tehran and Washington to settle the remaining issues. Iran also said on Saturday that it had imposed sanctions on 15 more U.S. officials, including former Army Chief of Staff George Casey and former President Donald Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, again, as months of talks to revive a 2015 nuclear deal have stalled. Almost all of the officials named served during Trump's administration, which imposed sanctions on Iranian officials, politicians, and companies, and withdrew the United States from Tehran's nuclear deal with world powers. The Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte and Chinese President Xi Jinping stressed the need to exercise restraint to maintain peace in the South China Sea, Manila's presidential office said Saturday. The two leaders held an hour-long telephone summit on Friday discussing a broad range of topics, including concerns over the Ukraine crisis and COVID-19 pandemic responses. Sri Lanka will need about $3 billion in external assistance within the next 6 months to help restore supplies of essential items, including fuel and medicines, to manage a severe economic crisis, its finance minister told Reuters on Saturday. The island nation of 22 million people has been hit by prolonged power cuts, with drugs, fuel, and other items running short, bringing angry protesters out on the streets and putting President Gotabaya Rajapaksa under mounting pressure. For more on these and other stories making news today, please visit us at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
That level of capacity is one of the critical focus areas the Netherlands often brings, beyond the technology that is also needed, beyond the investments in the project.
Netherlands Prime Minister Mark Rutte joined several current and former African leaders to raise $30 billion a year in water investment in Africa.
When people say using state resources, to what extent? It's not only limited to campaigning for the candidate, but like I have mentioned earlier, it coincides with the Meet the People talk, which is constitutional. It is mandatory that the president does that in person, as the law says.
Gambians vote in legislative elections Saturday.
At the end of the day, we will know whether, you know, they are innocent or guilty. But before, you know, the court making any decision, we are supposed to be abided by the law and just, you know, follow the legal process.
And Guinea's former ruling party expresses concern that the ruling military junta is harassing previous administration officials. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Netherlands Prime Minister Mark Rutte has joined several current and former African leaders seeking to raise $30 billion a year in water investment in Africa. Rutte is the co-host of the UN 2023 International Decade for Action on Water Sustainable Development. It follows the recent launch of the International High-Level Panel on Water Investment in Africa in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. The panel includes the Prime Minister of the Netherlands and Senegal's President Macky Sall. It also includes Namibian President Haige Geingob and former Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete. The objective of the panel, officials say, is to develop pragmatic ways to mobilize $30 billion yearly until 2030 to help implement the Continental Africa Water Investment Program, as well as close the water investment gap on the continent. For more on the role of the Netherlands government, I reached via Skype Henk Ovink, the Netherlands Special Envoy for International Water Affairs and spokesperson for the Prime Minister.
The Netherlands was one of the leading members of the high-level panel on water. Panel with 11 heads of states, the Secretary General of the UN, President of the World Bank, that led the world towards more water awareness. That high-level panel on water concluded that that complexity has to be at the core of sustainable solutions. This high-level panel on water, where my Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, was honorary member and I was a Sherpa of, concluded also that in Africa, the gap when it comes to investing in water is massive. And that gap needs to be addressed to ensure water security for all. That it is about water and sanitation. And you know, we come from this pandemic, we're still in the midst of it. But we learned from the pandemic how important water is. Water and sanitation and hygiene are a first line of defense in such a pandemic. But for billions of people across the world, that first line of defense is just not there. So securing water is of critical importance for health, for opportunities, for women, girls, children, for the most marginalized around the world, but also for our biodiversities, our urban economies, food security, and across.
But Hank, somebody would ask, why is the Netherlands, and by extension, the Prime Minister, and you, interested in investment in water in Africa?
We learned it the hard way in the past, that if we don't work together on water, we fail. So working together on water in our own country, in our own continent, and across the world secures sustainable development for everybody. So that is one. Second, as I said, we know a thing or two about water, and that is not only the technology on how we deal with water, making sure that we have clean water, that we can treat it well, that we can reuse and recycle water for a sustainable water cycle. So we have expertise on technology. We also have a lot of expertise on capacity, on education and on governance. And of course, the finance, knowing that investing in water trickles down across the values and needs in society. That understanding of water, that capacity we have in water, and the expertise we have to connect with other partners around the world. The ones that are in need, but also the ones that can help strengthen that need. And this African Investment Program is one of the initiatives coming out of the High-Level Panel on Water. It's such a critical next step.
Talking about the expertise and the capacity that the Netherlands has, will there be a transfer of knowledge or grooming the locals on the African continent in some of these technology exchange to help build capacity so that this investment in water doesn't go to waste?
Yeah, it is really about, we call it with a chic word, enabling environment, which is more or less the umbrella word where it is about capacity, capacity of individuals, capacities in communities, in partnerships, capacities that are very informal, that are in schools with youth, with the young, with girls and boys, but also capacity in our institutions, public and private, businesses and financial sector. We need to capacitate the world to be able to deal with water, to value water according to its values. That is of critical importance. Only then a solution can have a rippling effect. Only then there is real ownership to see implementation and maintenance and operations. Because often we just have one-offs. The project's being delivered and then everybody lets go. This level of increased capacity that goes across society, across all actors and stakeholders in the communities, I think that is also one of the things we want to bring. Making sure that it's not only about the technology, this is about the social capacity, societal capacity, community capacity, but also government capacity. Inclusion, transparency, being able to see solutions through, work in partnership with communities, with private sector, build business cases that have and sound opportunities for investment, and so forth. Projects and pipelines that are based on solid strategies, policies that are aimed at the future, and not responses to the past, that are proactive, that are really about sustainable transformation. So I think that level of capacity is one of the critical focus areas the Netherlands often brings, beyond the technology that is also needed, beyond the investments in the project.
Henk Ovink is the Netherlands Special Envoy for International Water Affairs and spokesperson for the Dutch Prime Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Amsterdam. Gambians vote in legislative elections on Saturday. It could give another boost to President Adama Barrow to strengthen his power after winning re-election last year. Voters will elect 53 lawmakers to five-year terms. Barrow will pick the other five, including the parliament's president. The elections come as civil society and opposition groups accuse the president of illegally using state resources to support his party's candidates ahead of the polls. Dudu Ja is the executive secretary and deputy secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction. The party remains a part of President Barrow's ruling coalition. He tells me that today's elections are competitive, but remains confident of the party's success.
APRC as a political party, we're still in the alliance with the incumbent, that is the National People's Party. We have put up 7 candidates in 7 constituencies. We're expecting a very peaceful election. Though voter apathy, it's what is also been expected as we're in the month of Ramadan where Muslims are keeping fast. And besides that, and I believe civic education to tell the people about the importance of the parliamentary election also is lacking.
What are the prospects of your party in today's elections?
Mr. Peter, we're expecting victory for all our 7 candidates, 5 of whom has served as members of parliament in the last parliamentary for a period of 5 years. They have the experience, they have the technical know-how, they have what it takes to lead their people again. But they will face a very tough challenge in the 4 years, taking into account the recent unfortunate incidents of the Senegalese soldiers' encounter with the MFDC rebels in Casamas, the Fonyi area. Some people are definitely not willing to take voting very seriously. They're lamenting and crying out for government to provide security, especially two of the polling agents or the polling booths that are very close to the Casamas border. And people are in fear that peace is not fully restored in the Casamas-Gambia border. But the other two have also got the experience of serving as councillors at local government level. So all seven candidates have definitely have the experience of what it takes in leading their people and serving their people and representing them. So the likelihood is we're going to win the seven seats.
Well, Dudu, some political analysts are saying the United Democratic Party, the main opposition led by Usainu Dabo, currently dominating parliament, will come out tops and make President Adama Barrow's life quite difficult. How do you think your alliance would help push your candidates forward in this alliance?
Mr. Peter, that is quite true. Us being into alliance with the ruling party, the biggest opposition party in the Gambia now is the United Democratic Party, UDP. They had majority of seats in parliament in the past, and they are not going to let that go easily. It's an open election. We're expecting that the percentage of any candidate winning is 50-50. Parliamentary elections are very difficult to predict because it is the people who empowers you and give you the vote according to where they settle, that is the constituency where they live. It's very unpredictable, just like the local government elections likewise. But this I can assure you, our alliance is no pushover, and it is the biggest alliance to ever happen in the political history of this country. Like we did in the presidential elections, the expectation is we are going to repeat that. Majority of seats is going to the alliance, and the rest assured about that. But we're not undermining the opposition parties, even the independent candidates. They have a chance of winning, but we have better chances of winning and grabbing majority seats in parliament.
Well, Badudu, President Adama Barrow is being accused of using state resources to help campaign for candidates of his party, and by extension, your party. How do you react to this?
Mr. Peter, this coincides with the Meet the People tour annually that the president does. It's mandatory. It's the law that states, Section 222, subsection 14-15, that the president in person must go around the country to meet the people. He used the opportunity to reach out to every constituency and tell them thank you for massively voting for him during the presidential election. Again, it's next to the parliamentary elections. He wants to use the same opportunity to campaign and sell his candidates. Every president would want majority seats in parliament. Without the Meet the People store, I do not believe that the president would just get up, use state resources and campaign for his candidates, but he just managed to do it both together simultaneously. And when people say using state resources, to what extent? It's not only limited to campaigning for the candidate, but like I have mentioned earlier, it coincides with the Meet the People tour, which is constitutional. It is mandatory that the president does that in person, as the law says.
Dudu Jah is the executive secretary and deputy secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In In Guinea, the former ruling party, the Rally of the Guinean People, or RPG, is expressing concern that the ruling military junta is harassing previous administration officials. The party has since threatened to suspend its participation in meetings organized by the junta if the alleged harassment does not stop. The remarks come after a former prime minister and three former government officials were arrested for graft this week. This as the military government embarks on an anti-graft effort to hold accountable former officials in the previous administration who are accused of corruption. For analysis on the latest political developments, I reach attorney Thiano Balde, president of the Research Institute on Democracy and the Rule of Law, a civil society group.
You know, this is really surprising for so many Guineans. Keep in mind, those people were in power just a few months ago. And they arrested hundreds of innocent civilian people. They sent them to jail. Some of them died when they were in custody. Some of them, they have been traumatized for life. And today, they are supposed to be accountable to their management. So instead of following the legal process, making sure that they explain all of the crimes that they have been committed so far. They are, you know, crying out, saying this is an harassment. They have to tell, you know, Guineans why they decide to go for the second term for Professor Alpha Conde, which lead, you know, to so many people dying.
Don't you think they have a legitimate cause to complain that the members of the party are being targeted following the recent arrest of three prominent members of the party over allegations of corruption?
No one is above the law. They have been in power for many years. And every citizen here in Guinea know exactly how well they were their way of life. The fund that, you know, was supposed to be spent for building schools, medical care facility, the roads, and so on. None exist in Guinea. You wonder, where are those funds? And someone was in charge to manage that fund. So they have to explain what they did with those funds. It's very simple.
Some of the supporters of the party are saying that although they acknowledge the anti-graft crusade by Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, it looks like they are being targeted and they threaten not to be part of any discussion with the junta. How are the people of Guinea reacting to this stance from the former ruling party or the RPG?
Most of the Guineans, they are thinking that there is a deal between the junta and the former government. Otherwise, we have seen in all of the countries where there has been a coup d'etat, how those people were treated. Everyone here in Guinea know exactly how they were conducting themselves before President Alpha Conde was brought down. If, you know, since they took the power, until this day, they are free, they are moving freely, they are speaking out, and no one didn't say anything. It's just something that can be very difficult to explain because we have filed hundreds of complaints against so many of those people for corruption, for assassination, etc. And none of them have never been called to any of the court here in Guinea. And now the power have changed. They have to answer about, you know, what they have done while in power. And making threat is just because the junta is very friendly with those people, and the junta doesn't want to conduct themselves like it has to be done during President Alpha Conde regime. So I think everyone, you know, has to calm down and then just use the legal process. At the end of the day, we will know whether, you know, they are innocent or guilty. But before, you know, the court making any decision, we are supposed to be abided by the law and just, you know, follow the legal process.
Attorney Fiona Bade is the president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law, a civil society group. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Malawi, civil society and journalists say they are displeased with the recent arrest of Gregory Gondwe, the managing director of Platform for Investigative Journalism. The groups say the arrest violated constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech. This after the police arrested Gondwe and confiscated his computer and phone for publishing a story on graft. Local media reports the police pressured Gondwe to disclose the source of document he used for the story. But in a meeting with journalist groups including the Media Council of Malawi and the Malawi chapter of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, the Attorney General apologized for the arrest. Information Minister and Government spokesperson Gospel Kazako says the government will investigate the circumstances that led to the arrest. For more reaction to the arrest of journalist Gregory Gondwe, I read Teresa Ndanga, chairperson of MISA in the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Well, we welcome the apology and the regrets that the government has expressed. But I think in the first place, it was not necessary to get to where we are, where a journalist would be arrested. And the reason behind the arrest is that they want him to reveal his sources. Nowhere in the world is a journalist forced to reveal sources, because that's essentially killing journalism. And ironically, this is happening at a time when this same administration, when it came to power, it operationalized a law, the Access to Information Law, in which for the first time we actually have protection for a journalist. It stipulates that a journalist cannot be forced to reveal his sources. And here we are, the same administration under which this law has become operational is again arresting journalists and forcing them to reveal their sources. So it's quite ironic, it's quite unfortunate, very regrettable indeed, and I hope that it is sincere what they are saying. Because we would expect that if they are sincere, we would never face the same challenge that we have faced now.
Teresa, after the arrest, the Attorney General apologized. The Information Minister says that they will investigate the circumstances that led to the arrest. Your reaction to that?
We have heard in the past similar sentiments. We, for instance, previously in other instances where journalists were also attacked by state institutions such as the Malawi Police, have engaged the Office of the Inspector General of Police himself. And unfortunately, it keeps happening. So right now, even though we have really accepted the apology and the regret, we would want to wait and see if indeed they walk the talk. Because it seems like one arm of government is doing another thing, another arm of government is saying a different or positive rhetoric, but the action on the ground is different. And what we are saying that is that they should learn to align the policy direction with the actual instances on the ground, with the actual actions on the ground. If they don't do that, unfortunately, it reflects badly on the administration. It's not just the Malawi police in this case, but it reflects badly on the highest office of the land. So it is time for them to really align their policies with actual action on the ground, so that at all levels of the administration, they are walking the same talk, they're doing the same thing, and it should be uniform.
So, Isa, when you met the Attorney General, he says the government will review some of these so-called archaic laws to ensure these circumstances never happen again. What does that mean?
So I think this is a positive development because I think they know that we, as an advocacy body, we have been pushing for the repeal of some of these archaic laws. They continue to be used in this current democratic dispensation, and we think that they don't have a place. For instance, there is a law in which they say, you know, you can't insert. The word they're using is insert the president. But they interpret a simple criticism of the presidency as an insert, and people have found themselves, you know, in cells behind cells simply because they have criticized the president. And we have been airing our views and asking administrations in the past, including the current one, to repeal these laws. Also review some of the current laws. There are modern laws, such as the cyber security law. It's modern, just passed a couple of years ago, but it has sections that really are fighting the freedom of expression. So that too needs to be reviewed. And therefore, we think that, you know, the Attorney General's sentiments are a welcome development. He actually said they will be drafting a bill around that. So we will be following up, because I think they made a commitment to us. We made that commitment public because we would want to hold them to account on what they say. So we'll be following up on the processes that need to be followed to get to a point where we either repeal or review some laws.
Teresa Indanga is chairperson of the Malawi chapter of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Cameroon, Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has suspended its humanitarian activities in the western part of the Central African country. This after the authorities arrested four medical staff members of the organization. The group also expressed concern that 4 months after their detention, cases against them have stalled with no progress. The authorities say they are investigating them for working with militant of secessionist groups, an accusation Doctors Without Borders sharply denies. Sylvian Gruel is the head of MSF programs in Central Africa. He tells me that MSF remains available to continue the dialogue with the authorities to resolve the issue as soon as possible so that they can resume their medical humanitarian activities.
Yeah, we're very, very sad, and it's a desolate situation for us. We had to take this decision just because we were not able to ensure the security and safety of our teams anymore. Essentially, what we have is the government now accusing our staff for doing their medical work, giving them broad accusations of complicity to secessionism, when all we're doing is treating patients and going out into the community. So this is extremely worrying for us. It's impossible to work under these type of conditions.
But Stephen, has MSF engaged the government to try to resolve this problem?
Yes, we have tried for many, many months. However, we have not been heard very, very much. We have fallen pretty much on the deaf ears. And we don't understand why. We're more than happy to have a discussion on all aspects of our work. We have been transparent and open since we started working in this crisis some 4 years ago. And we don't understand why now all of a sudden, after 30 years of working for the Cameroonian population, that our work is now criminalized.
The authorities are saying the investigation is due to their alleged complicity with secessionism, those who seek to become an independent country, to be called Ambazonia, and because they are dealing with them, that is why they were arrested and are being currently investigated.
Well, for us, what we do is we deal with patients. You know, if you look at the last year, what we've done is we've had almost 2,000 deliveries, safe deliveries, over 800 surgeries, you know, some 165,000 medical consultations, of which over 40,000 of those were for children under five. I mean, our work is not related to only the people that are involved in the armed context right now. We're talking about a population that is made extremely vulnerable by the fact that if you look at the figures, there are hundreds of thousands of people that have had to flee southwest and the northwest since the beginning of this crisis, and those are the people that have been able to. The ones that are still there are the ones that are most vulnerable, the ones that cannot leave the area and unfortunately have to endure this violence on a daily basis. So our work is not towards armed actors. Our work is towards populations that have that are extremely vulnerable and have extreme needs.
English-speaking Cameroonians are expressing concern that this is not the time for MSF to suspend its activities in the areas, particularly when there's ongoing conflict between the secessionists and government troops.
Well, not only that, we'd had to leave at a time when there's a cholera epidemic ongoing in the Southwest. We have been supporting the Ministry of Health since the month of November in trying to deal with this cholera epidemic, which is now increasing and which was flaring up. And again, we've had to stop all of our activities because we cannot ensure the safety and security of our colleagues to treat patients. You know, treating a patient, doing medical work is not a crime.
So what is the message of MSF to the authorities in Cameroon based on your decision to suspend activities? Because those who are negatively impacted by the conflict, as well as those who have been affected by this cholera epidemic, would suffer because of the suspension of your activities there.
Well, we want to return as soon as possible to do our work. You know, we understand that there are needs there, and we feel that we want to be able to return. But it has to be under certain conditions. First and foremost, our colleagues who are currently being detained in jail should be released immediately. And following such, we need to have a discussion with the government and having them understand what we do, how we do our work, and they need to be able to accept that. As in any country where we work, we never do things behind a government's back or an armed group's back. We can only work in those zones. We don't work with armed escorts or anything like that. We work only because both parties of any type of conflict respect our work and ensure the safety and security of our teams, full stop. And in this case, until those guarantees can be obtained, it is very, very difficult for us to return.
Sylvain Groul is the head of MSF programs in Central Africa. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Millions of people in the Sahel and West Africa are facing the worst food crisis in a decade as conflict and climate disasters send the price of essential commodities soaring. Yuri Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The World Food Programme says the region is facing an unprecedented food crisis. It reports the number of hungry people across West Africa and the Sahel has quadrupled to 41 million between 2019 and 2022. This includes 16 million urban poor at risk of acute food insecurity, with many already surviving on a starvation diet. Sibolo is WFP Senior Research Assessment and Monitoring Advisor for West and Central Africa. Speaking from the Senegalese capital, Dakar, he says 6 million children in the Sahel are suffering from malnutrition and that undernutrition is a general problem throughout the region.
The economy is recovering from the COVID impact, but still very slowly. Last year, the agricultural season was extremely bad, and millions of farmers have lost the production, and many of them will not have enough food that will last until the next lean season or even the next harvest season.
He says conflict has displaced more than 6 million people in the Sahel, and border closures also are causing food price hikes. He says this all is adding to the hunger crisis.
The farmers in particular, they are worried for the next agricultural season, mainly because many of them will not be able to access to fertilizers. The cost of fertilizers has increased by almost 30% in many places of this region due to the supply disruption that we see provoked by the crisis in Ukraine.
The United Nations reports the conflict in Ukraine is disrupting the global trade of food, fertilizers, and oil products. It says shortages of these commodities are driving up food and fuel prices across the globe. Olo says WFP needs $777 million to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance for 22 million people in the Sahel and Nigeria over the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
After forming government in August 2021, one of the things that Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema immediately implemented is free education for vulnerable children from primary to university level. Since implementation, schools are facing critical shortage of desks and classroom places, with pupils sitting on the floor while learning. That problem, however, is slowly being dealt with as Swedish government, through the British Investment International, has pledged to construct more schools in Zambia with girls a priority. For VOA, Elias Lemwana sent this report from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Health Minister Sylvia Masebo said that with the COVID-19 infection positive test rate at 4% in the country, it is no longer mandatory to have a negative COVID to enter Zambia if a person is vaccinated.
The COVID-19 outbreak situation in the country is encouraging as we note that the fourth wave is subsiding. The number of cases being reported daily have reduced significantly, with the SARS-CoV-2 national average test positivity rate of less than 5% for over 3 weeks now. We also observe a reduced number of persons with COVID-19 being hospitalized or succumbing to death due to the disease.
The Minister of Health further indicated that churches, pubs and nightclubs can operate without restrictions, and churches which were limited to meeting 2 hours twice a week have been urged to operate on full blast.
We have adjusted the following public health and social measures with immediate effect. There will be no restrictions on population movements and travel and business operations. Persons traveling to Zambia will no longer need to have a PCR test. However, one must be fully vaccinated to forego the test. Those not fully vaccinated must provide evidence of SARS-CoV-2 negative PCR test.
But some people have concerns about the government's decision. Nutritionist and rights activist Joseph Moyo, who has a chronic illness that compromises his immune system, warns the move exposes people in his situation to the pandemic. There are worries about how the government will ensure the public adheres to safety measures such as wearing masks and social distancing in public places.
Zambia and many other African countries have zero capacity for rapid response whenever health problems rear their ugly heads in their countries and within the continent. There is no ability to be able to respond at short notice and put up mitigating measures. By the time a problem is detected, it will have already spread beyond the capacity of those countries to manage. Many African countries, including Zambia, have no capacity to develop their own vaccines. We are still countries that are more dependent on the Western technology. And that is a danger for any country to outsource its health to other countries, because when such pandemics spread, those countries with that technology will first use it for the benefit of their citizens before they can send vaccines to other countries.
On the other hand, for the Livingstone Tourism Association, which has seen over 60% of job losses, the move is important. Hilary Kashempa is chairperson for the Livingstone Tourism Association.
We are very happy that our government has come through and just relaxed the travel guidelines. Clients or visitors wishing to come to a beautiful destination no longer need the PCR negative test as long as they are fully vaccinated.
The National Public Health Institute has recorded nearly 4,000 COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic broke out. For VOA, this is Elias Limonya in Lusaka, Zambia.
Experts say Zimbabwe has done better than most in its rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine. The country is among the first to vaccinate in Southern Africa. This successful campaign has been linked to generous vaccine donations from China, India and Russia, and by government's deliberate efforts to buy the medication. For VOA, Kutsai Zvanavashi has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Dr. Norman Matara is with the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights.
With vaccination, the government has actually done well, more than what most people expected. I think the vaccines were made available free of charge. They are in abundance and they are accessible by everyone. But I think the main problems that we faced, the initial rollout of the vaccine, we rolled out the vaccine without properly educating people, and most people had some myths and misconceptions surrounding the vaccine.
Zimbabwe is currently sitting on stockpiles of COVID-19 vaccines. At the start of the campaign, the initial distribution of the drugs was promising, but that has since slowed down. Dr. Agnes Mahomva is the head of the National COVID-19 Task Force.
Complacency, we absolutely also noticed that's a trend and we were concerned about it. This is one of the reasons why we introduced the vaccination blitz, where we have lots of communication on radio, television, in community radios, you name it, to really get people to come out in their numbers to be vaccinated. We've got plenty of vaccines. We have always said we've got plenty of vaccines and that will cover our blitz and beyond.
The vaccination drive has targeted school children. It's also been pushing for those already vaccinated to get booster shots. Life as it was known before the pandemic is slowly becoming reality in some parts of the world. Recently, South Africa ended all COVID-19 restrictions. Dr. Matara says Zimbabwe is still not in the clear to borrow a leaf from neighboring South Africa.
I don't think we can be in a position to say we are out of the woods when we have not vaccinated more than 70% of the population. As it stands, we do not have a high number of active cases. Momentarily, we are a bit safe and we may consider relaxing the COVID-19 restrictions.
Mahomba says, despite the goodwill that existed by vaccine donors, Zimbabwe purchased over 90% of the drugs. Now efforts are focused on vaccinating more people and reaching herd immunity before any return to normalcy can take place. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvanavashi from Harare.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection. Just listen on.
Monica, Monica, Kukutera, Tagara, Nani, Ranya, yeah. wasafita akastaki yemuita akata kujiko mentita akastaki meshavimbika akastaki hey mwambieni mwambieni
Le 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 le
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Mohammed El Shenawi and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, we are people because of other people. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.